at some point, I'm sure we have been titled 17th Annual Doctor Who Panel.
I'm Grant Watson. This is Colin Sharp. This is Guests of Honor Straight Around.
Yay! Yay!
This is better than Simon.
And I'm wearing a boring cover.
She's sexier.
Danny Oz and Damien McGee. Yay! And today we've come to talk to you about a very interesting year of Doctor Who. This is the 24th season of the original series, which was broadcast in 1987, from memory, from about September. But Damien's got a book, and he'll correct me in a second. And it's the first season starring Sylvester McCoy as the seventh Doctor and the final Doctor of the original series. This is the start of the last three years of the original programme.
7th of the 9th, 87.
All bad things happening.
That's not actually something to be proud of. I don't know. Did you want to say anything about the lead into it? Or
I think we should just give a quick background to the lead into it. There was a bit of a power. The previous couple of years, there'd been a bit of a power struggle going on in the BBC. And the show, Doctor Who, was one of the battlegrounds for this. So there were problems with, budget was being shifted, there were fights over the length of the series, changing of formats, all this sort of stuff. One of the other shows that suffered in this was Star Cops.
Yeah.
Star Cops got cancelled. You know, that's, everyone remembers the Doctor Who had an 18-month hiatus. Everyone forgets that a really well-written show, Star Cops, got cancelled. And this sort of came to a head, and even though the show's ratings were improving at the time, I always forget his name.
Michael Gray.
It was controller of BBC One, which now, is now in charge of the entire TV station.
Now he's controller of ITV.
Yeah.
He
basically, at the end of the previous season, had basically said, get rid of Colin Baker, the previous Doctor, just like that. So, sack him.
Well, he was too violent, that's what he said.
He was just searching for excuses, though. It really was a case of, I want an excuse. And sacked him, and at that time, John Nathan Turner thought that previous season was to be his last season. He'd been trying to leave the show for some time.
Yeah, at this point he'd been making the show for 7 seasons?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He'd been trying to leave the show for some time. He was trying to move on, and the BBC kept on reeling him back. So the previous season had ended. The show was going to go on, but as far as John Nathan Turner knew, that was his last season. He was now a free agent. He was going to be able to look at producing other TV shows. Colin Baker got sacked. So it was a big turnaround.
The interesting thing with Colin Baker being sacked is John Nathan Turner actually phoned him up and, with remarkable tact, actually apparently said, well, Colin, I've got great news and bad news. The great news is we've definitely got a 24th season, the bad news is you're fired.
Yeah. The way Colin ended it is, you're not in it, was what he said.
But then on top of that, they then asked Colin to come back and just do one final four-part story to sort of, do his regeneration scene and have a grand climax.
And
Baker very sensibly said no, because if he committed to those four episodes, it means he wasn't available for filming for any other TV series, so he couldn't actually put himself out there to get any other roles in anything, because he was committing to four more episodes of Doctor Who, and then effectively probably nothing for the rest of the entire year.
Yeah. And as it was, at the time that they would have been filming anything with him in it, he was actually in a stage play.
Mm.
He ended up getting work pretty much. Yeah, he basically said no to them, and then the next week got offered a stage play to run a stage play. But then John Nathan Turner came back from his holidays, and I was like, he went, right, so what am I going to do now? Well, John, we're going to give you Doctor Who. No, I'm done with that. You're doing Doctor Who, John.
They had no time. There was no lead. Normally, there's months of lead up.
There was no script.
In one season, they were already developing scripts for the next season, but the previous script editor, Eric Saywood, had actually resigned over there was a big kerfuffle in the year beforehand. And so they didn't have a script editor, so there was no one for several months developing new scripts for the program. John Nathan Turner assumed he was leaving, so he didn't care that there was no scripts being developed for the program. Then suddenly he comes back from holiday, finds he's got the job. No scripts, bar the one script that he had commissioned, which is the first one here,
Dying
the Rani, for an entire season of Doctor Who, which at this point was going to be 14 episodes.
Yeah, no script editor. Yeah, so he was stuck in a job that he didn't want, so it was going to be a hell job for that year. He had to find a new lead actor, four stories. It was just a hellish thing. It doesn't forgive how bad season is at times, but it does at least inform. There's times when it's absolutely despairingly bad, and other times where it's just bad. And there's the occasional little peak where it goes, oh, that was watchable.
One line.
But yeah, but it's very much a case of, it was the most unenviable task for any production team, any producer, any lead actor, anyone you can imagine.
And was Doctor Who showing on Saturday, or was they still competing with Coronation Street?
Well, the previous season they showed it on Saturday evenings, where Doctor Who had always been. It was 5:35 on Saturday.
Yeah.
Which in the autumn in Britain, it's getting darker, it's more of an evening. It sounds like an afternoon slot in Australia, it is more of an evening slot for the UK. It's not. You can tell it's Friday, Monday. I don't know if it's Friday, but you can tell it's Monday. This season, the BBC decided to schedule it at 7:35 on Monday night, Wednesday night, I think it was. 7:35 on Wednesday, so it's directly opposite Coronation Street, the highest rated TV drama in Britain.
Now, Michael Grade, there was no secret that Michael Grade wanted to kill off Doctor Who.
He hated
it. When he put it under hiatus, there was a huge outroar. So if you're going to kill something, the best way is death of a thousand cuts in this sort of case.
Yeah.
And that's effectively what he was doing. And we're going to put it up as Coronation Street, because, you know, that's how much faith we have in the show. And it's like, nothing ever survived against Coronation Street. And he knew this.
And the problem they had is that when they measured, they've changed it in a lot of countries now, when they measured ratings in 1987, where people had, like, a set-top box, or more often they just had, fill up form, what shows did you watch, and say that, and they extrapolate out statistically what the viewing audience for a show was. It didn't record anything you recorded onto video. So a lot of families have a choice between watching Coronation Street live or watching Doctor Who live and videotaping the other. They'll watch the soap, the Coronation Street thing is two nights a week.
Yes, yes.
They'd watch the soap live, they'd watch the soap live and record Doctor Who to watch later. And so, therefore, Doctor Who's ratings didn't really get recorded. And so it looked like the show was very unsuccessful, but in truth, we'll never know now.
Yeah.
Well, I think more people recorded Doctor Who in the UK than ever before, because kids were, had to go to bed, people were working late, so...
Yeah.
And more people had video recorders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, yes.
And so Time and the Rani came about because John Nathan Turner was depressed that Pip and Jane Baker had been able to turn around some scripts in a very short space of time in the previous season. So he approached them, gave them an idea of what he wanted.
Get a list.
Yeah.
I wanted an alien planet. He wanted to bring the Rani back, who had been a very successful villain 2 years earlier, played by Kate O'Mara, a rival Time Lord. He wanted a new monster, and he wanted a giant brain.
Mm-hmm.
John Nathan Turner was a producer who was very much, he'd have an idea in his head, like, I want a story with a giant brain would look really, really cool. And then the writer would have to find some way to incorporate a giant brain into the story. And you see it all through sort of his tenure as a producer. So that was their list, and they went away at very short notice and no script editor for most of the writing process.
Yeah.
Trying to come up with a full-part story.
Then Andrew Cartmell was hired as script editor, and he actually had a difficult time because he was then trying to finesse their script that was already written. And he said this in a couple of interviews, he was trying to finesse their script as it was already written into what he imagined the show to be, and he now goes, that was a huge mistake, I should have left their script as it was and concentrated on the other scripts for the season. But it was also his first time as script editor.
Yeah.
And
computer programmer.
Yeah.
Who did a BBC writer's course. Submitted a script that people really, really liked, and the head of the BBC script unit who develops new writers, recommended him to John Nathan Turner. He knew Nathan Turner was really desperate for a script, so he said, well, this guy seems to know how to write, he's got an interest in science fiction. Use him. And so it was this guy who had no experience as a script editor, and to be honest, no experience as a script writer.
He had written scripts for a series called Claws, which was about cat breeders.
Oh, okay.
And that was, I think that was being filmed or about to be filmed at the time when he sent in the scripts to JNT and stuff and said, this is my stuff. And so, but he'd had very, very limited experience, and certainly none as a script editor. And so I suppose that takes us into Time and the Rani.
So shall we begin?
Yes, such a good
one. Right, well, okay. Okay. You're off to the first clip now.
Yep. Are you sure?
It's the fabulous pre-credits. This is how we get out of not having Pat Baker to do a regeneration.
Explain
it, actually. Run through all the clips?
Yeah, let's just run through it.
Okay.
Number
one, I did do a clip on that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know what I'm doing.
Melody, are you alright, Doctor? In your laboratory. Oh, my gosh. Doctor, are you sure you're well?
Of course. This is Tango.
Tango. This is a pimple.
No, as I expect.
Well, let's see, what are we up to, No, did you see anyone else? You don't remember me, do you? Do you?
Red hair. And you call red hair.
Why, who's that?
That's you.
That's you, Doctor.
Me? Oh, I wonder I've lost my memory.
Okay.
That's my natural humility.
With a guy called Ken Campbell, who's a very old performance artist in Britain in the 60s and 70s. It was called the Ken Campbell Circus Roadshow. The only other actor other than Ken Campbell and Sylvester McCoy to ever really get any great success who came out of that group was Bob Hoskins, who worked with... So he was a weird cabaret performer, but when he was Ken Smith, he did a solo cabaret show where he was playing a character called Sylvester McCoy, and did a show called An Evening with Sylvester McCoy, The Evening Bomb. The human bomb. Where he shoved live ferrets down his trousers and did madcap strange stunts and just stupid comedy stuff. And in order to convince the audience that this strange man was real, he actually went and changed his name by default to Sylvester McCoy. And people who know him who've been interviewed said that he actually changed his personality at that point to become the guy you see in Doctor Who. And it's just never changed back. He never changed his name back. He just went for the rest of his life as Sylvester McCoy. So he's a very weird man.
Very nice man.
Oh, yeah. But, just watching those clips, particularly that first one, the thing that really grabs me is he absolutely has no idea what he's doing with the character at this point.
Yeah. And that's most of the season. You can see that he's... It's partially that he has no idea, Although this was one thing that was fortunate for him. Colin Baker was placed under a lot of restrictions. No, you're going to wear this costume. No, this is the way we want you to play the character. No other Doctor had been put through that.
Mm.
But Sylvester McCoy got back to, what do you think would work as a costume? How do you want to play the character? All that sort of stuff.
And he evolved it that he was able to develop it in the way he wanted it. I think the only thing he disliked the costume was the knitted...
he hated his clothing. I don't know if you got too good an impression from the clips we had, but one of the things that always impresses me about Time of the Rani is in terms of its production values, the way it looks, the visual effects, the monsters, you know, the tetrads, actually sort of four-eyed bat monsters. It's the highest production values Doctor Who's pretty much ever had at this point. So visually, it looks really nice, to me anyway, and really nicely directed by a guy called Andrew Morgan, who came back the next year and did Remembrance of the Daleks.
It's so Pantone though.
Well, that's the thing, the visuals are amazing, and so there's this huge leap forward in the quality of Doctor Who at this point. But the script is so incredibly childish at the same time. And music in particular, like that scenery is changing. The costumes and the music is like overplaying every joke, like every time he says a joke, which isn't that funny to begin with. It's kind of funny if you're a kid, but it's almost like they're afraid you might not get there's a joke there, so the music's like, you know, really irritating.
And it's worth pointing out at this point that this is the season that stopped Teresa watching Doctor Who.
Absolutely. I was so impressed with, guest of honour, it's on con, Doctor Who panel, yeah! What? You're doing what? What season?
Good. Come back next year.
I'll come back next year. Yeah.
The fact that I watched this when I was 12 and I thought it was great when I was 12 and I've never seen it again since, it's probably a good thing.
It's funny, as we're coming into this panel, we're talking about it, and you know, Simon and Grant, who are both big Sylvester McCoy fans, suddenly realised we don't actually have this season.
Actually the first season I ever saw, and then I got to Paradise Towers, and it wasn't until they re-showed Doctor Who on TV a few years back that I watched it again.
Keep your childhood memories.
Yeah.
If you have fond memories of this season, keep them. Don't ever re-watch it. Never.
I still love Paradise Towers.
I think that's
the one story out of the season that I'll still rewatch and enjoy at the same level that I did originally.
I think also it's a season where we see the end of Mel and the beginning of a great
Mel. I have a thing about I mean I don't know, I have a thing about Mel. It's a bit of a worrying how she's reinvented herself as a British gay icon. But she's like, gay men in Britain are obsessed with Bonnie Langford. She does cabaret shows and just gets filled up with gay men.
They're all gay teenagers when she was in Doctor Who.
Bonnie Langford, when this first came, I'd seen this on TV when I was 12, and obviously I'd seen her in the previous season with Colin Baker, and really wasn't a fan of Mel. She really irritated me. She was so grating. She's over the top. She acts like she's in live theatre. My family went on holiday to Europe for 3 months, and when we were in London, you do the London thing, you go and see a show on the West End, and we went and saw a musical called Me and My Girl, starring Bonnie Langford. And if you see her live on stage in a musical, she is brilliant. She is an absolutely sensational live theatre performer and musical theatre performer. The problem is that's her acting style, and in Doctor Who, she acts like she's in musical theatre. And if Doctor Who was a musical on stage, and you were all the way back there when you were watching her here, she's fantastic. But the moment you put a camera this far away from her face, she's all, you know.
But the trouble is, as a child actress, she was exactly like that. She actually appears in the live action of Wandering Free. With the voices done by John Pertwee, does the Wombles, and she was in a TV series called Just William, and she behaves exactly as
and as Queen and Queen and Queen.
Yes, that's that. Yes, exactly. So her acting style on camera is over the top, and I haven't seen her on stage, but obviously she's totally different.
So it's one of those, and this is what I think derailed this year of Doctor Who, is there's so many elements that aren't in themselves bad, but when you put them in the wrong place, or they've given them the wrong emphasis, or they'll do a serious story with really bad music, and the music makes serious scenes look comical. There'll be a really serious moment that's... there's a moment in Time and the Running, that's really subtle that really disturbed me when I noticed it, which is Sylvester McCoy walking through sort of the, you know, the isolated, desolate planet surface, finds the skeleton of an alien who you've seen be horribly killed earlier in the episode, like she gets, you know, put in a sort of spinning bubble trap and explodes, and it's just the shard remains. And he asks the Rani, dressed as Mel, you know, oh my god, something's died, what's that? She's like, oh, it's a curse, and they don't matter, and walks off. And he looks really, really sad, and then just as he's about to leave, he doffs his hat, he's like, and walks off, and it's suddenly this really horrible joke at the end of a serious moment.
And the other thing about that is, originally McCoy wanted to shake its hand.
Mm.
The director stopped him. And this is one of the problems. McCoy remembered the Troughton era and wanted to go for that sort of, and he remembered it as being comedic, and that's what he wanted to do. And there's a number of moments like that in that story. There's a bit of recursions before they go into their centre of leisure. There's a rock, and they all kiss their hand and touch the rock as they walk in, and all of them do it, and they all do it, you know, pretty much a very straightforward, this is what we do. And he can't help himself. He, as he walks past the rock, he and like slaps the rock and hurts his hand, and it's like, and that sort of unsubtlety is there all the time. And the mixed metaphors thing, you know, a bull in a barbershop, all those sorts of things. That was something that John Nathan Turner wanted in there. He and Cartmell put all that stuff in the script. And you know it's got to be a bad idea when Pip and Jane Baker are complaining about it. Because they can barely write their way out of a wet paper bag, and they're going, this is crap. This is rubbish.
Writing's crap.
Yeah.
So
we
move on?
Yes.
Now, Power Dice Towers, here are the clips. Good to come on.
Now, pick a few moments to make it. That is going to be I want to tie the wall.
I need the sleeping
Are these old ladies annoying you?
No!
Are you annoying these old ladies?
And you either! And I do wish you had a breaking through our door to try and see, but the third time we've had it repaired, and it's not as though we've ever been in any trouble about our bitter door flying around all over the place. But who exactly are you?
My name is Pex. I have the number of Paradise Stars.
Nine deaths at the break of death must take place.
Besides,
even if the war scrolls out of them, it's probably time they were taught this severe lesson.
I picked those clips to sort of illustrate different aspects of the story that either worked or didn't work. And one of the things I like about it is like the Kang's slang. It's very complex, but you know that kind of works for it. At times the audience would be saying, what are they saying? But once you watch enough of it, they say like Clockwork Orange, you start to pick up what they mean by different things. It's a story with a lot of good ideas in it, but they don't all quite gel. I didn't use the whole sequence of the Doctor's Rule Book, partially because it's actually very, very long. Mm-hmm. It seems like a short sequence, but it's nearly 2.5-3 minutes on its own.
Oh, it's 4 minutes, that's right.
Yeah.
But
you know, that's the sequence that a lot of people go back to and remember. Richard Briers is the chief caretaker. I showed two clips of him like overplaying it to the monster and then him being a bit cold at the end. It's one of those hard things because in interviews he actually said they seemed to be really worried that I was going to overplay it, so I did. and that's the thing. You see him when he's overacting to the Cro-Agnon machine thing. He's like, oh well, my darling, my pet. And then you hear him talking about the wall scrawlers, and his eyes are steel hard. And right at the end, he says, "It's high time they were taught a lesson." And it's like if he'd played it like that, in amongst all this other insanity, it would have been absolutely chilling.
The thing I really like about that scene with Sylvester McCoy and the book. Is that, to me, the first scene that he's played as the Doctor where you suddenly realise he's suddenly got a hook on what his character's going to be like? Mm-hmm. And there's something a lot... I mean, it's very crude compared to sort of how he performs in the later seasons, but there's that very manipulative thing. Yeah, absolutely.
And it's one of those things with the script that there's a lot of good ideas in there that didn't quite get pulled off. Tex was meant to be a big, heavily oiled muscle man, Sylvester Stallone type. That's what the writer actually said very clearly in the script, that this is what he's like. He's got to be this big, you know, buff guy, you know, because he's a coward right throughout the story. He's always terrified. Mel saves him on at least one occasion. But the thing is, when they started auditioning the big muscle guys, none of them had the sense of humour to be willing to send themselves up. So they ended up going for this actor. All the caretakers were meant to be much old fat guys. They were all meant to be old fat guys who'd been there for 20 years and were still obeying the rules and all that, but all their costumes were meant to be dishevelled and all this. So there's this whole breakdown of society, and a lot of the elements that go into it just aren't there.
It missed on every level for me all the way through. I just, the whole series, I remember watching that first two episodes to the end. I just went, I don't remember it like this. Have I got older? And then I sort of left it. Came back, watched a couple more episodes, and went, nah, I'm out of here. I have grown up. I love Doctor Who, and I can go back and rewatch, you know, Colin Baker, and go back and watch Tom Baker, Patrick Charlton was my favourite, John Pertwee. But
Compared to Time and the Rani, this story is an order of magnitude better, but it's still not that good. I actually do like the story, but it's like watching liking the Runt Kitten. It really is.
So I think the script has an awful lot of merit. I actually think it's a very clever script, but they directed it on. They directed it and cast it and produced it very, very badly. One of the things that did, I think, also hurt it was that the score was written, I can't remember the name of the guy, this guy actually composed the entire score to the story. And then 2 weeks before it was broadcast, John Nathan Turner decided that the score was too dark and subtle and he didn't like it. And so he dumped it at the last minute. But it was actually a major pay dispute with that guy trying to get paid for the work he'd been contracted to do.
Yeah.
And he got Kev McCulloch, who did the music to Time of the Rani, and he's probably the worst musician
I've ever heard. Oh, he was.
He got into the music, and again, he overplays every moment with his music.
Yeah. And it's the initial idea came... the writer was a big fan of a book he had read recently by J.G. Ballard called High Rise, which is about people living in a high rise and the breakdown of society within that high rise. And whole chunks of the idea of Paradise Towers are taken from that book. But again, it's a flawed story, and as we've already said, a lot of the flaws are in the production itself. And if you can watch that story, if Richard Dreyfuss had played it seriously, or if he played it completely comically, in the last episode, he's possessed by Criagnon.
That's my silliest part of it.
And so here's his chance to play it seriously, but what he's doing is he's stumbling around going like, "Not scared, are you, boy?" And it's just, no, you've missed the mark again. And to some degree, you're also going to blame the director. The director should have.
He's got a very good actor there. So
yeah, and I've seen him play straight roles, and he's fantastic. Mm. In fact, just about all the actors in there have been seen on screen playing straight roles.
Well, Harrison McGough plays his deputy in the radio series for the BBC of Sherlock Holmes.
And yeah. He's Sherlock Holmes.
And he's sensational.
Yeah, he's great. Yeah.
But it's that, and that's one of the problems with this season, is there's no real direction in that it's uncontrolled. One of the big improvements for that story is they've dropped most of the mixed metaphors that were in the previous story, which were really, really, really
killing your nerves.
Oh, drove you nuts. But at the same time, you still have at the start of the story, the end of the story, the Doctor doffing his hat to a piece of machinery.
Mm.
And Mel gets into a pool with a giant yellow crab and doesn't see it. And is attacked by it. Yeah. It's just...
That was, it struck even me when I was going to... You idiot, what the
fuck
are you doing?
And that's it, there's lots of... That's the other thing about this season.
No, I just exactly said that.
Doctor Who wasn't always the best written series, but the writing in this season is incredibly sloppy. There are so many unanswered questions.
I think a lot of that comes down to the fact that you do have a script editor who has never script edited a television series before.
And a producer who didn't care.
I think the producer cared.
He cared, but he didn't really want to be there.
Yeah, he didn't want to be there. One of the problems John Atkinson had is every year he would quit, and every year the BBC would say, "That's okay, John, you can quit." No, look, Doctor Who's going to get cancelled. And he was so terrified of going down the history of the man who killed Doctor Who. Year after year, he stayed on.
And also added to that, though, John Nathan Turner had other projects that he'd been developing, and the other thing they kept on doing is, we'll cancel Doctor Who, but they also had the carrot on the stick. It's like, oh well, yeah, you can do that, John, but you know, we're not gonna help you do this other season. We want you to do another season of Doctor Who, and then we'll let you do the series that you want to do.
No.
I mean, seriously.
And he never got it done.
And he died quite a few years ago.
There's an interview with him in a documentary where he actually says, and it's a heartbreaking moment, where he just goes, "I'd hate to go down in history as the man who killed Doctor Who, but I think perhaps I am." And the guy was trying to leave. You can't be stuck in a job that you don't want to do for 10 years and do a good job. Yeah, he started mucking around with the series because he was bored. He had to make the series workable for him to keep going.
Well,
Doctor
Who before that had rickety stage scenes which used to wobble when they came on and stuff like that. So, we could cope with that, but you still had to use your imagination and fill in. So instead of having rickety scenes that wobbled, you had actors that you had to fill in with stuff for. So it still made you use your imagination to the fullest.
Mm.
I still couldn't imagine how exactly the ecology thing works. I mean, they were getting stuff to make sweets and pastries and stuff, but where else was everyone getting their food and why were they eating animals? It was a very contemporary idea that they were playing around with gangs and stuff like that. Never saw anything about gangs on telly.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, in life on the streets, you know, we all had the different gangs that we belonged to and everything. It was like at the time the nearest thing that I could relate to on television that actually reflected some part of it, you know.
It's an incredibly clever story. It just needed to be handled better.
Yeah. I mean, you've got all that history going on behind the scenes.
Yeah.
And it just all came through in the TV show because everyone was just so miserable on set. Nobody wanted to be there.
Okay. Well,
that's how miserable that are.
The story of Delta in the Venom.
Just freezing between one bit and the next.
That's why it's shaking.
He's afraid.
This is Malcolm Cole's first script too. Big story.
Hello, guys. From the top of the White House, Washington DC, this is a priority call for Code 11. Hello, this is Agent Jerome P. Weissmuller speaking from Wales in England. right on, it's well, that was the president's right-hand man. Wow, come on, what? Lois, still the beans. We'll have a red alert. He says it's fake down or he's flying a space rocket with an artificial satellite. This is his dream. I made him watch more. Surveillance.
Yeah, like that. Yes, yeah, that one.
That was the space bird. Oh, there.
Send your whole new to the sea of the queen.
Affirmative. 1 million units.
I found her. She's at a place called Shangri-La in South Wales, Western Hemisphere, but I'm not into this signal to guide you in.
The reward will be yours when we arrive. Thank you.
No unexpected plans. Your defender in time, Mr. Holder. Your death will make me interested. If you come for money, tell the girl go. She's worth nothing to you.
I don't just come for money. It's also something I enjoy.
Still
there.
I will give you one last.
What the hell is it?
You know, I'm lying, Jabrock. Being dead, lies, tricking, murdering, you can't see. I'm sorry, but in the end, it will be life which defeats you. You must have time and space to find this anomaly. I will. I came here under one flag, and I will leave under that same white flag. I'm all become every level which is its integrity. Fire! Raise this
the bounty hunter. How did he know that that's the actual doctor who's actually just regenerated? And the question is, who's put the bounty on the doctor who, I mean, that's the question that really was
probably
interesting.
Several.
Right.
We've got
bounty out on him.
Maybe you two will
succeed
in
getting
him out. 6 years ago.
But I suppose the most inept two characters that they didn't really need are the two American agents. Obviously, yeah, obviously they're, and who someone said they're fake American accents? They're not. They're both Americans. Stubby K is well known as a Broadway star who's appeared in films such as Lil Abner and Sweet Charity. And also the balloteer in Kakaloo. Yeah.
Are they expositional sort of comic relief?
What, in this? I think they were comic relief.
They actually do nothing to forward the story at any point. You could actually edit it and take them out completely, and it would not affect the story in any way.
No.
I have a lot of affection for this story. When it was first on as a kid, this was my least favourite story of the year by a mile. I hated it. And as I've gotten older, I've appreciated it more and more, because for this period of Doctor Who, it's very rare. And Paradise Tales is the other one this year that shares this. They don't have any references to the Doctor's past. It doesn't rely on the knowledge of a previous story to understand part of the new story.
Yet still you don't own them.
We've got 5 minutes.
Well, we started 10-15 minutes late. So we're going to keep going, damn it.
I must admit, I also like, one of the reasons also I like is some of the performances, like Don Henderson as Gavro. He's really one of the best villains I've seen in Doctor Who for a long time. Mm. This was his second to last role. His last role was in Paradise Club.
That was great.
Oh, that's brilliant. But I just think that some of the scenes were totally wasted, like when he's shooting up the radio and goes in and gets all glued by the honey and all that sort of thing. I just thought that was total waste. But the end scene sums up the whole story about the Queen, going to a new hive and everything. But it was a nice little touch.
Yeah. One of the issues with the story is, it's not actually an issue with the story. Sarah Griffiths, who played Ray in there, she was in the cupboard with the Doctor with the guy who had the gun. Originally, this was going to be the last story of the season, and she was going to be the new companion.
Mm.
And it's very interesting, because if you look at her performance in that role, and you look at Sophie Aldred in Dragonfire, Sarah Griffiths does a much, much better job.
Absolutely.
Significantly better.
She would have been a great companion.
She would have been a fabulous companion.
Sorry, yeah.
There's a random bit of BBC trivia for you. Delta of the Band was filmed in a place called Barry Island.
Yeah.
And when recently a friend of mine introduced me to a series called Gavin Spacey.
Yep.
It
was
also filmed in
Paradise. Oh, okay. You know what else was filmed on Barry Island? What
was that?
The scenes in The Empty Child with the Doctor.
That's right, they filmed that. And it's been a place that in Wales has had 2 episodes of Doctor Who filmed in it. As far as I know, Barry Island.
Well, we might have a few more now. Shall we move on?
Yes, move on to Dragonfire. By Ian Bruce.
You always have the best of our pictures. So there we go. I remember how you sold our entire crew to the process versus
she's not that good.
She has a couple of really good moments.
She has a couple of really good moments, and some really quite dreadful ones as well. It's very, very mixed. The whole story is deeply flawed as well, just from a plot point of view, because you know the main character, his whole motivation is to go back to his home planet and take over and kill everyone and get revenge. And the only way he can do this is by getting the Dragonfire back to power the station. When he could just get on any one of the ships that docks,
turn up the air conditioning really hard,
take his little cabinet with him, and go. So,
of all the flaws I spotted in the story, I actually completely missed that one.
It's really obvious. Someone pointed out that you could have left at any time. He has the money for it too, because he's got like this huge freezer center. He's been making money off for 3,000 years.
The thing that always grabs me about that story is that if this had been broadcast 10 years earlier, and there had been a shot in primetime television, the show aimed primarily at children, in which a man's face melts off on camera, there would have been riots in the streets, there would have been a discussion in Parliament, and Mary Whitehouse would have had an aneurysm. And the fact is that at this point, Doctor Who at its height in the original series, the ratings, apart from the odd spikes when they had like strikes on ITV and that was what it was, the ratings would peak out at around the 8 to 10 million range. At this point, the ratings were down to about 4 million. And there was no one noticed.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it's
quite
a graphic effect.
Yeah, they did edit it down too. There was originally a bit more graphic.
Actually, one of the funny things about that story is you're watching it, and all the sequences that have Kane in them are absolutely riveting. It's old Doctor Who. It really is. He's a fabulous villain. He's playing it dead straight.
Yeah.
And every time you get the regular cast, you get the Doctor and Mel and Glitz to some degree and Ace, it's back to being crap.
And well, the reason I put that cliffhanger scene is A, it's the only time in the history of the show that the cliffhanger is someone hanging off a cliff. and B, there was no particular reason for him to be doing that.
Well, no. And the cliffhanger of that particular episode should have been with Mal and Ace.
Yeah.
As the monster coming towards them, that's where the cliffhanger should have been.
But part of it, though, is direction and production stuff. It was filmed badly, because in the script it's very clear that the Doctor is going along. Yep, we started 15 minutes late, but we're finishing up. So in the script, the Doctor goes along, and there's been an ice fall. He can't get through any further. And he looks over, and there's a ledge below, and he's trying to lower himself down onto the ledge below. And it's all clearly laid out in the script.
But
when they filmed it,
yeah.
It just didn't work, because it was not clear.
And him stumbling along as if the floor's all slippery when it's quite clear to everyone that that snow is so very fake.
But that was also in the script that this floor's are slippery, and McCoy was the only one who remembered that.
Yeah.
So that comes down to the director.
Exactly, he was the only
one. If everyone had been doing it, then it would have worked.
Yeah.
We are running out of time, so I just want to give some final comments to wrap it up.
I think the certain aspects of the season worked. So I think Paradise Towers worked in some respects, but I think Della and Ben and the Dragonfire showed where the sign of Matthew McQueen as a Doctor was going in better seasons.
I suppose my thing is it almost feels like the season we had to have, because by the end of the season Ace is introduced, and in seasons 25 and 26 she's fantastic. She comes across as very sort of ropey now, but at the time, in context, she was great. Sylvester McCoy is great. The tone of the stories is great. And it's just almost sad that because of the circumstances at the start of the year, that it took them an entire season to ramp up to work out what they were doing again, at which point most people were watching anymore.
I mean, yeah, the next story after Dragonfire is Remembrance of the Daleks.
Brilliant.
Which is several orders of magnitude better than what she had in that season.
So you should all go watch that one.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll fill in the blanks. You guys give me the episodes I need to see.
I'll watch Remembrance
of the Daleks. It's a kick-ass Dalek story.
It is.
Really kick-ass Dalek story.
I think that's pretty much
Yes?
Yeah.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you very much.